From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, Herb Kohl announces he'll sell the Bucks for more than $500,000. What'll that mean for sports in Milwaukee? Later, a Milwaukee company tries to reduce the guesswork in gluten-free cooking.
When you're living with celiac disease or gluten intolerance, we've heard that it's hard to eat out because of cross-contaminations and options, so you have to cook at home every day. This is a way to alleviate some of those pain points.
And another Milwaukee company tries to update a device that hasn't been improved much over the years, the walker.
We recognize that this is very different than what's been done for the past 60 years, and we feel like it's a much more powerful message coming from the users to the industry than coming from us to the industry.
Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Great to have you listening today. The future of the Milwaukee Bucks basketball team came into sharper focus yesterday. In front of a large audience at the BMO Harris Bradley Center, owner and CEO Herb Kohl announced his search for new investors in the team was successful.
We're following through on an announcement that we made just a few months ago that we were launching an effort to find additional investors in the Bucks to help strengthen the franchise and keep it rooted here in Milwaukee. As you know, I was born and raised in this city and have lived here all my life. Being part of the effort to bring the NBA franchise here originally and then keeping it here has been a big part of my adult life. I have owned the Bucks for more than 29 years, and our fans, our business partners, and my colleagues at the Bucks have been on my mind and in my heart every day. So I hope you understand why this process was and is so important to me and why I was not going to make a move unless I was convinced that it was the right one. I'm pleased to announce that we have been successful. This process started late last year when I asked Steve Greenberg of Allen & Company to help me to look for financially capable investors who shared my love of the game and who shared my commitment to keep the Bucks in Milwaukee. Working with Steve and his colleagues at Allen & Company on a daily basis, I believe we did a great job in finding the two gentlemen that I am pleased to introduce to you here today. I can tell you that there was a lot of interest in the Bucks and a large number of highly qualified potential investors emerged. The process evolved along the way, but most important to me was finding investors who shared my commitment to keeping the Bucks in this city. The two men I will be introducing today know Milwaukee and know that this area and this state have great sports fans who deserve an NBA franchise and a championship caliber team. They also know how much I love Milwaukee and how important I believe the Bucks are to the future of this entire region and to our state. They understand, and we've come to agree, that in order to keep our franchise here, we need to get to a 21st century sports and entertainment center in a timely manner.
Former U.S. Senator and Milwaukee businessman Herb Kohl announcing yesterday he plans to sell the Milwaukee Bucks to Mark Lasry and Wesley Edens for $550 million. Edens also addressed the audience.
Mark and I are very excited to join Bucks fans, the city of Milwaukee, and the citizens of the state of Wisconsin. As the senator said, my mom was born and raised in Wisconsin. I'm from Montana originally. I have a lot of roots in the Midwest and in this part of the state, and I'm delighted to be fortunate enough to be standing here talking about owning prospectively the franchise of the Bucks. So we're very excited about that. Mark and I are lifelong basketball fans. We're competitive guys, and we've had a lot of fun with basketball over the years. We spent a lot of time on the sidelines watching our daughters play basketball. Two of them are here with us today. And we are really looking forward to the experience of being an owner. And as the senator said, this is a new stage for the Bucks, is a new stage for the arena and the facility that we expect to be building here, and are delighted to be entering into that process. It really is. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be an owner of an NBA team on day one. It's also a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to build a facility that, of course, is something that's a big collaborative process with government and with the citizens and all the people and the team and whatnot, and we are delighted to be at the beginning part of this.
Wesley Eden speaking at the BMO Harris Bradley Center yesterday afternoon. He and Mark Lazary have entered into an agreement to buy the Milwaukee Bucks from former Senator Herb Kohl, pending league approval. Howie Magner is our regular sports contributor, and he joins us in the studio to break down this announcement a bit further. Nice to see you.
Good to see you, Mitch.
This was a big announcement that on first blush would seem to give basketball fans here a pretty big sigh of relief. But are there still some questions that exist?
Well, there's a lot of questions. Number one being whether or not the arena that the new owners for the Bucks are going to propose. The new owners, Mark Lashley, Wesley Edens, they came in. They were very impressive in their opening press conference. It's clear that it's very clear why they were able to make billions of dollars, because they know their stuff and they know how to present it well. And I think they came off very well in their introductory press conference along with Senator Herb Kohl. And it always helps when you step in front of a crowd and say, here's $100 million toward your new arena. And the senator matched that with his $100 million. So you're out of the gates with $200 million in private money that you didn't have to work with before. And the figures that they threw out for a new arena are in the neighborhood of $400 million. So if you go with the low end of that, you're basically halfway there. And everybody said that's the starting point. You know, there are other non-public sector monies that can be drawn from, and you're looking at things like naming rights and other corporate partners or perhaps minority owners, whatever. But it's entirely possible that that they get over the halfway threshold with private money. Now, $200 million or $150 million in public money is still a lot of money, and they're still going to have to do some convincing to the city of Milwaukee, to the surrounding areas, that it's an investment worth making. But I think they're off to a very good start. They're certainly in a better position to make that argument today than they were yesterday.
It seems like the future of the Bucks is at least somewhat more in focus in Milwaukee than it was just a day ago.
Absolutely, and that comes from not just the gift that they made, but you know who you're dealing with right now. You have the new faces of the franchise, if you will. Senator Kohl was instrumental in keeping the franchise here. Let's be very clear on this. We've said it before, and it merits saying again. If Senator Herb Kohl was not the owner of the Milwaukee Bucks, there would be no Milwaukee Bucks today. This team would have been sold many years ago to somebody who would not have put up with the financial losses, and they would have moved them somewhere else. Senator Kohl could very easily have sold the team for more money than he's getting, which is $550 million, to somebody else who would have moved the team elsewhere, to Seattle, to another community. So there's a great debt owed to Senator Kohl for the future of the Bucks, and that's to say nothing of all of his other community involvements. And so now you've got this new generation of ownership coming in Lazary and Edens, and you know that with something as dear to the senator's heart as the Bucks were and still are, that he vetted these guys thoroughly, and he wouldn't be selling the team to them if he didn't believe in their ability to take the franchise forward. And I think that says a lot. The new owners said that they will be very much on site as the process continues, and they have they've got some obstacles to overcome. They have to convince people in Milwaukee that they are trustworthy stewards of the team, that they're not just some outsider who's coming in and will make a show of trying to build an arena here, and when it doesn't work out, they're going to take it and build an arena in New York or New Jersey or pick your East Coast city, wherever, or you know, Louisville, Kansas City. They have to convince people that they want the Bucks to stay here as much, if not more, than Herb Kohl did.
Well, and so let's talk about these guys. Edens has some ties to Wisconsin, but certainly not in the way Herb Kohl does, or even some of the other local names that have surfaced. At the same time, this effort to find new buyers. It seems a lot less contentious than some other high-profile sports team sales. Herb Kohl said he was going to sell the team or find new investors a few months ago. Some names surfaced, and before you knew it, here are Wesley Edens and Mark Lazary.
I think that goes to Herb Kohl really knowing what he wanted and having a vision for how the process was going to work out and the types of ownership that he wanted to be in place to move the franchise forward. He said all along that the number one goal was to find a group that was going to keep the team in Milwaukee. And I have no doubt that he spent countless hours poring over all of the candidates, because word was that there were 9 serious groups that wanted to buy the Bucks. And when you think about how down the Bucks are in the eyes of many fans here, that's an enormous amount of interest for a team that has actually lost a fair amount of money. And every one of those groups came in knowing that the caveat, if they were going to buy the team, was that they were going to have to keep the team here. So Lazary and Edens really had to do something to convince Herb Kohl that they were the right group. And it really does strike you as an outsider, as a process that went relatively smoothly and one that had very few leaks, I might add. I mean, there were several names that, you know, were kind of natural names to go after, and Mark Attanasio and Junior Bridgman.
But that was all really just speculation.
Exactly. And the first mention of the new owners' names, at least in a public forum, came a week or two ago when Bill Simmons, who is a pretty well-connected national NBA guy, put their names out there. And the fact that there weren't any leaks before, just a couple of weeks before the sale was finalized, that really says something about the process.
Are these the kind of guys that the NBA is really looking for? I mean, they seem fairly uncontroversial.
Well, they got a lot of money, and I'm sure that really helps the process. I mean, I think if you combine the assets of both of their hedge fund companies, it's something in the neighborhood of $75 billion. I can't count that high. I can't even think that high.
And they are not Russian. Which
no,
is,
they're American. And they're basketball fans as well. I was speaking with County Executive Chris Abley, and he said one of the things that really struck him was the depth to which their fandom of the sport goes. And I think that's a good sign that they won't be absentee owners, that they will have a genuine stake in the fate of the team, that they won't just be owners who look at the team as a line on the spreadsheet and a way to make money or to, you know, hold for a couple of years and then sell to somebody else. So
they won't be Herb Kohl either, though.
No, not at all. They certainly will not have the ties that Herb Kohl has to the community. And that means that Milwaukee has lost something of its safety blanket with regards to the future of the team. And I think the first real wake-up call for that will be whether or not the arena gets built. And if the arena does indeed get built, it's a situation where, look, if the fans don't come out and support the team, then there's no guarantee that the team will be here down the road. But look, that's the way it is in any city. It just means that Milwaukee is at the same level that every other city in the NBA is at right now. They just don't have the security blanket of Herb Kohl anymore.
Is there a parallel to be drawn in this between the Bucks and their leaving the Herb Kohl name and the Brewers when the Selig family finally sold them?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of people out there who are hoping that that's the case because, look, I think Milwaukee overlooks the debt that it owes to Bud Selig for bringing baseball back to this city and for keeping it in the city for so long. But at the end of his tenure, the threat was, look, if we don't get a new stadium built, the team is leaving. That's very much what the Bucks are facing right now. And Selig found a new owner to come in, an outsider, financial whiz kid in Mark Attanasio, who really turned the fortunes of the franchise around. And now nobody talks about the Brewers leaving because they've got a beautiful facility and they've plugged money into the team. The profits have gone back into the team and they've been very successful. I imagine there are a lot of Bucks fans out there who would be very happy if the same fate befalls the Milwaukee Bucks.
Well, and that's where at the end of the day, the team still is finishing the season with the worst record in the league. There would be some hope that I'm sure the new owners would put the money that they're hoping to make on this team back into the team.
Yeah. I mean, look, the silver lining for this season is that you hope there's a bright future. You hope they get a very talented player in the draft, and they will have guaranteed one of the top four picks in one of the deepest drafts in recent years. You hope that you pair that with some of the young players they have on the team right now, like John Henson and Giannis Antetokounmpo and maybe Brandon Knight. And then maybe the owners come in and say, look, we're new guys and we're building this nice facility, and maybe Milwaukee becomes more of a attractive place for a free agent or two. Look, it's entirely possible. Other franchises have been turned around before. Milwaukee, there's no guarantee that it will happen here, but it looks like it's a heck of a lot more possible that it will happen here today than it did yesterday.
Howie, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch.
Howie Magner writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website, and he's senior editor at the magazine. He's also our regular sports contributor, and he joined us to talk about the news that Herb Cole plans to sell the NBA's Milwaukee Bucks to Wesley Edens and Mark Lazary, who will keep the team in Milwaukee. A short break now, and in just a moment, a local company aims to make meal planning easier for people with celiac disease. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The term gluten-free is much more common at grocery stores and in restaurants than it's ever been, as more people are diagnosed with celiac disease or gluten sensitivities. But that doesn't mean it's easy to prepare meals that are gluten-free. A Milwaukee company, though, is trying to fill in a big gap. Casey Lanto is the co-founder of Paired, a company that provides gluten-free recipes and sends pre-measured ingredients to make those recipes to subscribers. She joins us in the studio now, along with Sarah Nielsen, who writes the Milwaukee-based Celiac in the City blog and contributes recipes to Paired. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let me start with a question for you. Anyone who's spent time in a supermarket in the last year or two knows that gluten-free foods are certainly more common than they once were. What was still lacking in the whole equation in the marketplace that you were seeking to rectify when you founded this company?
Well, Mitch, that's a really great question. When we initially started Paired, we talked to many people living gluten-free lifestyle, try to find some of the pain points they had and solve for it. And with Paired, we heard, yes, there's a lot more options. They can be pricey, and sometimes it's risky. You don't know if it's going to taste good. You're spending $6 on a loaf of bread, and it may not taste like the bread you're used to.
Sarah, can you speak to the truth of what she was talking about?
Absolutely. I think, as Casey said, that she touched on price being an issue. $6 a loaf of bread is that's just common pricing these days for gluten-free. And I think right now I often tell people we're in the golden age of gluten-free because they are continuously adding products. I mean, the market has picked up on gluten-free being very popular. And but like she said with Paired, that it takes the guesswork out of it. Going to the store now, it's difficult for people because you have to read labels, extensive label reading. And then oftentimes you can't tell from the label if it's gluten-free or not. So you end up having to go and research, which, you know, a one-time 15-minute shopping trip could now take upwards of an hour and a half to 2 hours. And it's extremely frustrating for people.
So even though this is the golden age for gluten-free, that doesn't necessarily mean it's easy at this point.
Exactly. And for me, I'm 6+ years in, so the grocery trips are getting a lot easier than they once were. I always tell people that my first grocery store trip being gluten-free, I left my cart, I left everything in it, I left the store in tears. It was extremely frustrating. It gets easier over time, but if you're recently diagnosed, going to the store now with the amount of products that are out there, it's overwhelming when you walk into the gluten-free section.
Well, so let's talk about how you approached ingredient selection, if you will. I mean, you're talking about, you know, $6 for a loaf of bread, which is a lot of money. What do you do in terms of going out and sourcing your foods and saying, well, this is worth it and maybe this isn't worth it?
We test everything we send out, Mitch. So we have a weekly test kitchen where we bring awesome recipes from people like Sarah and all the ingredients that we'd use for those recipes and make sure we have a thumbs up for everything. We also work with a lot of local suppliers like Molly's Gluten Free Bakery in Pewaukee. She has amazing breads, flatbreads, and we make sure that we have a vote in the entire test kitchen. Everyone has a thumbs up. Tastes great.
How many people are in the test kitchen?
Anywhere from 5 to 7. So we have a lot of votes.
Well, who do you see as your primary customer base?
Sure. We started Paired to help people with celiac disease and gluten intolerance. People who, Sarah said, maybe newly diagnosed, frustrated, a little overwhelmed, people busy and possibly just need that convenience in their life of having the food delivered straight to them. When you're living with celiac disease or gluten intolerance, we've heard that it's hard to eat out because of cross-contaminations and options, so you have to cook at home every day. This is a way to alleviate some of those pain points.
Most of your recipes are aimed at serving 2 people, is that right?
Yes. All of our recipes serve 2 people. I'm actually glad that you mentioned this, Mitch, because we're starting at the end of April to start a subscription service that helps families. So that would serve 4 people. We've heard from a lot of our customers that they have children with celiac disease or just 1 person in the family, and they don't want to make 2 different meals every time they go into the kitchen.
Well, and so that was actually where I was going with this, because I would imagine there are a lot of people out there with celiac who live with people who don't have celiac, and the idea of preparing 1 meal for the celiacs and 1 meal for everybody else, not such an appealing concept.
Definitely. And to Casey's point about their test kitchen, I love that they have a large group of people, but also they're non-gluten-free people. So, I mean, oftentimes some of the products out there, I won't lie, you know, there's the cardboard tasting items that people spend a lot of money on. What I appreciate about the Paired team is that it's being tested sometimes by gluten-free people. There's times where, you know, I'm testing my own recipes, but it's going into a kitchen where they're giving it a thumbs up and they can choose to eat whatever they'd like. So to get the thumbs up from the non-gluten-free crowd is always a check in the plus column.
Well, and so what attracted you to the gluten-free cooking world if you're not necessarily needing to eat gluten-free?
We set up Paired initially to help people with medical conditions. We went through a series of interviews in the Milwaukee-Madison area, about over 100. And through that, we found a lot of people raising their hands saying, I have celiac disease and I'm having some troubles. So we found an area where we really felt we could help. And that's when we met Sarah, and she sort of introduced us to the world and helped us build the product out of Paired.
Sarah, can you give us some, I guess, insight into just what life is like for someone with celiac?
Yeah, just basically in layman's terms, that celiac disease is an autoimmune disorder that prevents anyone from eating wheat, barley, and rye. If you do so, then that can cause destruction on your GI tract and your small intestine.
This is it's a lot of pain.
Exactly. And when you're pre-diagnosis, the symptoms can range. I mean, there's upwards of several hundred symptoms. And that's why it's so difficult sometimes to actually get that diagnosis. And so people are oftentimes struggling to even get the diagnosis. Oftentimes when they go to the doctor, because the symptoms they vary so greatly that it's hard to pinpoint and figure out. They can't just put it into a nice little checklist. So I think that's a difficult for people to just get the diagnosis.
Do you feel like there are surprises, though, positive surprises in the gluten-free world? I mean, for people who have just been diagnosed with celiac or even simply a gluten sensitivity, this is obviously a frightening diagnosis. It sounds like things are maybe not as bleak, though, as they once were.
Right. And I mentioned being in the golden age, but also just as time goes on, it gets easier. I always promise people in the beginning, try to give them hope that it will get easier. Like I said, I'm 6 years in. I'm not lacking in any type of treats, sweets, or otherwise. In the products, even locally, we have a gluten-free beer from Lakefront Brewery. Comes right out of Milwaukee. So the options are out there. We just have to help people connect them with the right products.
How difficult was it to go out and source the ingredients?
Well, initially, when we first started the concept of Paired, we had Sarah's help, and we just went to the grocery store and were servicing boxes through that way as a startup. We start small. Now that we're expanding and we're using different vendors, the support of the gluten-free community locally has been tremendous. So we work with, like I said before, Molly's Gluten-Free Bakery, Linda with Cocina de Leon, some really great local products that we can send to people and introduce them. So I would say that it hasn't really been a pain point for Paired.
You know, so what we haven't actually talked about is how Paired actually works. If I understand correctly, you have both a subscription model and a one-off kind of pay to try something sort of model.
Yes, absolutely. So what Paired does is we'll take all of the measured ingredients needed to cook a gluten-free meal, deliver it straight to your home. We have the subscription model where you're going to receive two meals every week. You can pause, cancel at any time. Each of those meals right now serves two people. If you're a little afraid to commit to the subscription, we really stand behind our product. You can order just one meal, give it a try before you jump in.
As you say, they're measured ingredients. These are not already prepared meals. So there is still, I mean, the creativity of your own cooking that goes into this.
Absolutely. And I mean, Sarah can really talk to this as well because she's someone that supplies the recipes for us that are so delicious. But Paired aims to give people these recipes and ingredients, prep them, and you really just get to enjoy some of the fun parts of cooking.
I think that case in point for that exact situation is our friend Julie, who's been a consistent customer, and she is a person who has celiac disease and went from literally not cooking at all, not even, you know, boiling water for something very simple, to becoming a subscriber to Paired, learning how to cook. She now has utensils for cooking and knew everything. She's really taken a liking to it. And to be getting pictures from her of things that she's cooking now, it's very exciting. So to see someone who may not have experience with cooking, or for someone who is extremely busy and I just don't have time to go to the store maybe after dinner, but how great to have the box show up. Or the other idea for Paired that I like to give to people is just if you're having someone with celiac disease or that's gluten-free over for dinner, what a perfect way to feed them safely. Everything comes, takes the guesswork out of checking the labels. You can get that box delivered or have a couple boxes delivered and have, you know, a little buffet. But being able to safely feed someone maybe in your family or friend that has celiac disease or is gluten-free.
You've been in this to help customers meet the challenges they're facing in making meals. What have been the challenges you have faced in getting this business off the ground to the point that it's at now?
That's a great question. There's always many challenges, and most of them are unexpected. I think that a really big challenge for Paired right now is that, I mean, food is so personal, and everyone has their own nuances and things that they enjoy or don't enjoy. I think this is delicious. I love beets. And everyone looks at me like, beets?
You know? I may be looking at you like that now.
Right. But we hope that Paired can bring some of those new ingredients to your home and expose you to new things. And maybe you'd like a meal with beets prepared by Paired.
Or Brussels sprouts. That's a big one that people think that they don't like. And then you end up getting the box or you find it in a recipe and realize – a really great vegetable. We should be using it more often, and especially with bacon.
Well, and along those lines, Sarah, talk about some of your favorite recipes that you've developed in looking towards, you know, being able to scale them up.
I guess the big one that we always go to is the Italian chili recipe with the Parmesan garlic biscuits. They're a drop biscuit, which may not seem that exciting to people who may not be gluten-free, but we can't just go to a restaurant and have a bread basket. And so to be able to have them arrive at your home, and for those that don't know, baking gluten-free is difficult because you want to find that perfect flour mix, and it's expensive to either buy a pre-made mix or to come up with your own. So again, with the Paired box, you're getting all of that pre-measured. So you're able to try something out and feel like you're doing some kind of baking, but a lot of the hard work is already done for you. So that's a very popular one that friends, family request on a personal level also.
Well, and let me ask you this. You know, speaking as someone who has relatives who are gluten-free with celiac, I know one of the issues is cross-contamination at restaurants and the fear of even if a meal is purportedly gluten-free, worrying about whether there's left a, you know, residual gluten from a previous dish. How big a deal is that when you're cooking in the home?
For mixed households, Just being very careful. I always talk to people about sort of the gluten-free 101 when you first are diagnosed and, you know, getting rid of your toaster and some baking items, you know, pans that may have been older and, you know, things stick in there. And so just out with the old and in with the new for some things and keeping it separate. In our home, my husband has, you know, sometimes he wants a sourdough roll for a sandwich, and that's fine. We're just very careful about preparing it in a separate space, keeping everything that's gluten-free separate, and just being aware of, you know, what's going on in your kitchen. It's easy to do. It just takes a little bit of extra planning. You want to make sure you have a separate colander or strainer because gluten hides in the craziest of places, even if you think that you're getting something clean, which, again, relates to being at a restaurant. There's always that risk as well.
Does it become second nature after a while?
Absolutely. My husband just knows if he's having something with gluten, then that's going on a separate space, you know, with foil down or something to protect the counter and everything's cleaned up before we even do anything else. To him, it's definitely become second nature. Sometimes he's even more careful, you know, than I am, warning me, I've already touched that or there's gluten over there. And I think once you get used to it, it can be overwhelming at first. But some folks decide that they want to have a completely gluten-free household, and that's, you know, what might work best for them too.
Well, Casey Lanto and Sarah Nielsen, thank you so much for your time and best of luck with this.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Casey Lanto is the co-founder of Milwaukee-based Paired, that's P-A-I-R-D-D, which sells recipes and pre-measured ingredients for gluten-free cooking on a subscription basis. Sarah Nielsen has contributed some of those recipes. She is from Milwaukee and authors the Celiac in the City blog. One last break, and in just a moment, another Milwaukee startup seeks to help people with another medical issue, mobility. How Motivo is trying to build a better walker when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. For people with injuries or degenerative diseases, mobility can be a huge issue. The wheelchair has seen significant updates in the past 15 or 20 years. Changes to the traditional design and new motorized devices have made it easier for people with limited walking ability to get around. But another device has not changed much at all since it first came on the market. The walker is pretty much still the same metal frame it's always been. But a couple of Milwaukee designers are hoping to shake up that world. Jennifer Harris and Jeremy Canopo are the co-founders of Motivo, which has just launched its crowdfunding campaign this week. They join us in the studio along with the company's vice president of marketing, Mike Wisniewski. Nice to meet you all.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think it makes the most sense to start this interview by having you share what inspired you to take a pretty well-known device, a really well-known device, and try to come up with something better. What was it that got you thinking about walkers?
Well, for me personally, I had my mom injure her ankle and needed to use one of these, as did both of my grandparents needed to use walkers. And I saw firsthand kind of the struggles that they had with what was existing out on the market and really thought that there needed to be a better option for them.
Well, what were their struggles?
Well, my grandmother, for example, put off using one because she was afraid of becoming hunched over. She had seen some of her friends and other family members using them and was really paranoid that that was going to happen to her if she was going to use one of these.
And you had a personal experience as well.
Yeah. Well, my father struggled with ALS towards the end of his life and had to use these products as well. And like Jennifer, I was very disappointed with what was out there and how sort of 1950s medical-looking most of the equipment was. And then my grandmother also, who lived her whole life here in Milwaukee, needed to use a walker towards the end of her life as well. And similarly, just very disappointed with what was out there and thought we could do better.
This is really a device that that has kind of done the trick but really hasn't had any improvement since it was first invented.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the effort has been towards the functional side of the problem, right, versus looking more holistically at the whole person. And I think that's what we've tried to do is look at what's the total experience that someone really needs when they want to get from point A to point B beyond just the functional.
It's really remarkable to think that, this has not been really updated in any substantial way since it first came on the market.
Yeah, I mean that's the case, unfortunately, for a number of market reasons and regulatory reasons. You know, they came out in the 1950s really for returning World War II veterans and kind of stayed that way. You know, with small incremental improvements, of course, but nothing real major since then.
Well, you mentioned regulatory reasons. You're both designers. How much experience did you have in working with a design with a medical or therapeutic function?
Well, going into this, you know, we didn't have much beyond our personal family experience. But since then, we've done probably over 300 hours of research with users and healthcare professionals. We've been to the industry's major trade shows and conventions and really immersed ourselves in this industry and the users of these types of products.
Well, so how did you approach it? You said, okay, we want to create a better walker. First of all, how did you come together and bring together this team? And secondly, what did you do first?
For us as designers and going back over the years of doing other design work that we've done for any other project, you know, we try to start with what's the core need of our user. In this case, it's getting from point A to point B and having the convenience and comfort features. Instead of looking at trying to reinvent a product, we start with what's the core need. And that opens up a lot broader kind of opportunities for innovation. And then as far as our working together, Jennifer and I worked together for 4 years at SC Johnson creating new businesses for them. So we had a good opportunity there to kind of practice our cohabitation on projects with SCJ.
Can you talk about the kinds of things that you design? I don't know whether there's proprietary information out there that you don't want to get into, but you know, I'm curious the kinds of work that you did before you came to this project.
Well, I mean, going way back, I mean, I've worked on projects from school violence kind of related, how to reduce that. When I was at Kohler, we created this mobile shower unit for the rescue workers at Ground Zero that turned into a whole mobile business for Kohler that I ran for a while. And then I ran the global design for Fiskars before ending up at SC Johnson doing consumer product type things that you use in and around your home.
I've designed everything from gear for technology, laptop cases for the educational market at a company called Higher Ground. I've taught design actually at UWM in the art department, and also at SCJ identifying needs in specifically the home cleaning area. That was where I landed.
So when you have a project that you're working on that has such a personal connection for you, does it make it more fulfilling to do this work?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, seeing users say things to you, for example, I haven't walked this far in 4 years, or using your prototype allows me to do things and use half the effort that it would if I was using my current walker. And so hearing those things are extraordinarily rewarding for us. And getting that feedback lets us know that we're getting closer to designing really that product that we wanted for our parents and grandparents to use.
Well, I want to talk about the design of this Motivo itself in just a moment, but I wanted to bring Mike Wisniewski into the conversation because I imagine this is as much your area as anything. How did you look into the kind of demand that might exist for something like this?
Well, I'm relatively new to the company, started earlier this year, but Jeremy and Jen have done extensive research, user testing over well over 300 hours. And so it's kind of looking at that data and then kind of identifying that opportunity and then looking not only at the end user but the caregivers and then developing those type of kind of touch points through various types of social media, digital marketing, you know, in the way that the consumer experience is changing and identifying those touch points. And then that's how we're kind of identifying market opportunity.
Because presumably you don't want to go into something like this with just a hunch that people are going to want it.
Right. Absolutely. Much like their design, you know, the way that we developed the marketing plan and the go-to-market strategy has been based on data and research that we've uncovered and discovered and looked for those opportunities.
I imagine it is no coincidence that we're having this conversation as the baby boom generation is getting to the point where they're the market that would most likely need these things.
Absolutely correct. 10,000 baby boomers are turning 65 every day, so that market opportunity is growing exponentially.
And of those, we know 16% of the population, of the adult population, is going to need to use a mobility device at some point. based on a Department of Education-sponsored study that was done a few years ago. And there's a fair number of mobility-related studies that have been done around the world, particularly in the past decade because of the growth in the aging population.
So we've talked about the Motivo for a while now, but we haven't really described what it is and what it looks like and how it works. So walk us through, if you will, the highlights of this product.
As I mentioned, we've done numerous hours of testing with our prototype and talking to users and healthcare professionals. And some of the feedback that we've gotten from them is that there's really three top competitive benefits for the Motivo Tour. The first being that they can walk upright versus hunched over. The second, personal pride, that they feel much more like a person using this versus a patient. And then the third being that their independence is greatly increased because they're able to utilize some of the convenience features of the product.
Frankly, looking at the renderings of this, it looks almost like a podium on wheels.
When we set out to shape what this product might look like, one of the key things that we were trying to accomplish is to make it look completely like something you wouldn't find in a medical store or as a medical product. And we were able to do that through our lightweight aerospace-inspired monocoque design. And that was something that was important to us and important to our users.
There was a word you just used there that I did not recognize.
Yes. Yeah. So the monocoque, I'm guessing. So yeah. Essentially that's a shell structure or a hollow structure that creates significant support for a structure. So.
But they're solid sides as opposed to the frame that we're used to seeing in the old walkers.
That's right. Yeah. So monocoque, it's used in the aerospace industry. It's used in the racing industry. It's what has allowed our modern automobiles to be much more fuel efficient but still safer and lighter weight than the kind of older frame-on-body design, which also came out of Wisconsin. In Nash Automobiles in Kenosha was the first company to really mass market unibody design. So we feel like we're kind of bringing the same innovation out of Wisconsin but in this industry.
Well, and looking at the drawings, it appears that there are handlebars with brakes. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's important because there is a seat. And so when users want to sit down, they want to make sure that the walker is secure and stable. And also if they're walking on inclines, whether a ramp going up or down, then they're able to slow down the walker and slow down their pace using those brakes.
What is the significance of the idea that the user is walking inside the device rather than behind it?
Yeah, so the monocoque structure allows us to create a seat that can be stowed away versus one that is permanently fixed, as you'll find in a lot of the current walkers out there on the market. And because it can get out of your way, you're able to walk inside the walker and upright in a normal posture, whereas if you had the seat in front of you, it gets in the way of your normal stride and you end up walking behind it and hunched over.
Obviously, different users are going to be different heights. Do you make multiple models or is there a way for this to telescope?
The handles where you hold on to, they slide up and down so they can be easily adjusted to anyone's height that needs to use this type of device.
How much has it changed since the prototypes?
Well, which for, I suppose, yeah, well, we've got so many prototypes.
Yeah.
But,
I guess I'm curious, the tour that we see today in pictures, if you think about what it looks like today versus when you first started making sketches.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you go back, 3 years ago to our first sketches, it's changed quite a bit. And obviously, it's driven by all of the user input that we've gotten over the years. I think the non-medical consumer-focused design intent you would see carried through all the way from the beginning. But some of the convenience features like Jen was talking about, being able to walk inside and upright, being able to get closer to things, having storage that doesn't have to be emptied or removed when you fold it up, which is a big pain with the other existing walkers. I think those things have evolved over the course of our research.
You're really trying to kick this effort into high gear at this point. You're about to launch, as we speak, a crowdfunding campaign. Why go with that method rather than the other ways of raising money to get a company going, either a substantial bank loan or approaching an existing medical company and saying, we've got this device we want to sell to you?
Well, I mean, we're certainly doing it as a mix, so there's not any one kind of source. For startup companies, bank loans are not that much of an option because they typically want to lend to existing companies. So that whole arena isn't really accessible. We do have some friends and family that have helped kind of get us this far. But the reason for Kickstarter is kind of two main points. One is the practical side. It allows us to get some additional funds to get us over the typical cash crunch of a startup that happens right before launch when you've got to buy a bunch of expensive manufacturing equipment and build inventory. So there's that reason. And the other reason is we wanted to give a voice to this user group to be able to tell the industry that this is the kind of product that they want. We recognize that this is very different than what's been done for the past 60 years, and we feel like it's a much more powerful message coming from the users to the industry than coming from us to the industry. And so we feel like Kickstarter or whatever crowdfunding campaign we use is a way to give consumers that voice.
Well, what's in it for the person that would contribute to this? Because it's one thing to say, I need a product like this, so I'm going to go buy it. But it's another thing to say, I need a product like this, so I'm going to give money to the people who are inventing it.
Well, I mean, on the most basic level, you're pre-ordering a tour. So you're getting a chance to buy it at a greatly discounted rate, close to $200 off of what it would be retail. So that's the main reason. If you or a loved one needs one of these kinds of products and you want to get it at the best possible price, our crowdfunding campaign would be the way to do that. If you don't need a product like this or you don't know someone that does, you can contribute much smaller amounts in $1 or $5 or $10, and you'll get personal video message from Jen and I or thank yous or we'll keep you in touch and you can kind of be engaged in the creative process as we go forward.
You mentioned cost and for example, the discount that people would get for a substantial pledge to the crowdfunding campaign. Mm-hmm. One of the obvious benefits to the traditional walker is it's a pretty cheap piece of equipment. And for some people, this is really a temporary need that they use the old aluminum frame for a month or two and then they stow it in a closet and just get rid of it. Mm-hmm. This does not seem like a short-term piece of equipment that you were designing.
Well, that's right. And, one of our advisors is the owner and CEO of Knipples Healthcare here in the Milwaukee area. And so we've worked a lot with them in understanding really what people are buying most frequently and what price points. And for them, I mean, their most popular model is not the temporary gray metal folding up thing with the tennis balls. It is a rolling walker with the fixed seat, like Jen said, that kind of gets in the way of your legs. And those really are intended for more permanent kind of use. Where you want to get out and about and be able to do things. So that is kind of the bulk of the market now.
What are the kinds of regulatory issues that you have to deal with in creating something that serves a medical purpose?
Well, for this particular industry, it is one of the FDA-exempt categories, like canes and some other things, where they deem them like sort of low risk. So it's not really an FDA-regulated product. There is a ISO engineering standard that you can find around the world that we found is the most stringent, and we've designed the tour to actually exceed those standards so it can be sold anywhere in the world and meet the highest standards.
What about the kind of things that the user probably never even thinks of, like finding a place to manufacture something like this and finding a distribution network?
Yeah, well, we're very fortunate that Wisconsin is actually one of the global hotbeds for the particular type of manufacturing that we need to use in order to enable the kind of non-medical personalized design that we want. So there's actually no shortage of suppliers right here in Wisconsin that we could go and interview. And then on the distribution side of things, we'll be selling direct through our website and then also through the existing home medical dealers that you probably see in your area.
I mean, I guess obviously the two of you and probably you to some degree as well have some experience given what you've done in the past with being able to figure out how to network with these providers.
Jeremy and I have 40 plus years of developing new products and launching them and seeing them out on the marketplace and from everything from the incubation stages all the way through to sales and marketing. And so we're really leveraging that expertise in bringing this product, the Motivo Tour, out to people.
One of the things we have not talked about is the significance that when you have a product like this that has these solid sides, the design, the actual – what it physically looks like can be completely non-medical looking at all. And I imagine not that baby boomers are unique in this way, but there is a certain amount of being able to have things look like the way people want to look that goes into it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And that's what we've heard time and again from folks who use these types of products is that they really are a reflection of who they are. And the current products on the market really provide very limited opportunity for them to do that. And so at the Motivo Tour, we offer an assortment of colors that they can pick from to make it their own, as well as removable graphic sets so they can make the tour really reflect the type of person that they are and change them out as their moods change as well.
You could have racing stripes on this.
Absolutely. And flames and flowers and
mm-hmm. almost like Walker meets Harley Davidson.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mike and Jeremy and Jennifer, thank you so much and best of luck with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Harris and Jeremy Canopo are the co-founders of Motivo, a Milwaukee-based company that hopes to start producing its updated design for walkers, the Motivo Tour, later this year. Mike Wisniewski is vice president of marketing for the company. We'll have a picture of the Motivo, plus a link to more information about the company's crowdfunding efforts from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Thursday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Dyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.